Welcome to Season 6 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
Allplay has some new small box games for pre-order coming out in late May, early June. Also, if you're someone who's going to Origins Game Fair like I am, you can grab a copy there. It'll be its first show, it's debuting. So what games are we including in this? Well, there's Ruins, which is a fast-paced card-crafting shedding game from John DeClaire, where you use transparent cards to power up your hand as you explore mysterious ruins. This game in particular, I am the most excited for, because I actually learned about it back when we were both special guests at Grand Con last year. So check that one out, but also check out Oddland. That's a game where you explore a strange, uncharted island by laying overlapping tiles and documenting bizarre wildlife, each with its own unique scoring conditions. And then there's Vegas Strip, where you expose a corrupt casino using hidden info, bluffing, and bidding. With 20 different casinos, each with a unique power, every play is going to be full of so many different surprises. And of course, last but not least, we have Money, a Reiner Knizia cult classic returning. You get to bid, swap currencies, and build sets in the sharp, quick, fast playing game of economic strategy. Check out all these games, as well as all their other games, tables, bags, and all that good stuff at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 114, The Case of Curiously Correct Blueprints. Today we are joined by Ace Ellett, a co-designer as well as co-owner of Bluefish Games. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Well, I'm excited to have you on. It's been fun kind of getting to know you, but for anyone who doesn't know you, mind going into how you got into designing games?
Absolutely. My name is Ace. I am one half of several different things that all amount to the same thing, which is a publishing company, design company called Bluefish Games. We also call ourselves Team Bluefish. Being a team is actually just the two of us, just me and my wife, Anna. She couldn't be here today, but the two of us work together to design many different types of games. The most familiar vector sort of that anyone might be familiar with, the word for it is you'd say an escape room game. So you can think of a little bit of like unlock exit type thing, but without the pressure of like a time limit, without sort of the themes that you might typically expect in an escape room, more sort of puzzles like you'd get with when you cross like an escape room with something like a crossword puzzle, also mixed with maybe a scavenger hunt or a puzzle hunt. Those sorts of things are really where we work in that space.
That's super cool. And what got the two of you into that space?
We met in 2016, and at that time, I think each of us had done one escape room apart from each other, and we were traveling together. We were dating at the time, and we said, hey, you know, while we're traveling, how about we go and try one of these escape rooms, just the two of us? And we did, and had just an amazing time. We both love that kind of puzzly logic stuff. Both play lots of games like that. We played one, and a couple of years later, we were playing our 500th game, and I think we're probably around 600 games right now. So when Anna decided to leave her job, she used to work in the early literacy program at our public library. When she decided to leave our job, she looked at sort of what was next, and we talked about it, and we decided that it would make sense for us to take a shot at some of designing games. At the time, there was certainly maybe not the huge amount of escape room style games on the market for board games. So we looked at what sort of designs can we come up with? What can we do to create the puzzles that we love to play? So we started trying to move into that space. I know we ran a Kickstarter in 2019, I believe. That's sort of our flagship game. It's called The Curious Elevator of Mr. Hinks. It was kind of based off the idea of going from an escape room. We always loved the idea of like an elevator being able to open into different places. So like you step into an elevator, the doors close, you feel movement, something happens, and then the doors open. And usually you're just, you know, in the same building, obviously, but the idea was, what if it wasn't? What if you could do something, if you could go somewhere else, and what if a company could introduce that sort of experience to you? How cool that would be, especially something over the top. You know, you're in, close the doors on a office building and you open up and you're in the woods or something like that. So we tried to move towards a game that would give you a feeling of, I open this elevator door in lots of different places. And we came up with this fictional town of Hinksville. we never know how to describe him, but a leader in Hinksville is, or maybe sort of one of the original citizens there, is this Mr. Hinks character. And he's kind of at the center of all of our games. He's a factor or a force for fun, is what we'd like to call it. At any point, if something goes a little strange or, you know, something weird is happening, Mr. Hinks is there to kind of say, like, how could this weird situation turn fun? How could you look at it a little bit sideways and, like, come up with a weird idea of how to do that? There's a lot to say. We didn't know what we were doing, but we had this idea for this town that was really vibrant and had lots of possibilities. So that was, like I said, in 2019, we delivered early 2020, and Anna was all set to move forward creating a team building experience that was based on puzzles and some of the educational sort of maxims in escape room archetypes and that sort of thing. So hidden information and sharing information, that sort of thing, working together, team building basically. But she designed this a beautiful set of puzzle boxes that she would take into offices unbeknownst to us. That was the very beginning of 2020. And 2 months later, everything is shut down and no one's going into offices anymore. So we said, hey, that game, you know, that we designed, the elevator game, let's go back to that. Let's expand the town. What are they doing there right now? We wrote a monthly newspaper there that we released as a subscription. And every month, some crazy thing in the town would be happening. So one month there is, you know, often it's robots. I've got a spot in my heart for how can we introduce robots in kind of a weird way to society. You can imagine lots of different kind of off-the-wall situations happening. And each month you're going to talk about what's going on and how the citizens are turning that into like a positive, fun experience. That ran for a while. And this project that I'm actually here to talk about today is a audiobook mystery that kind of turns itself on its head, looking at that same town. It's a detective whodunit mystery that is sort of an abridged version of the original book, because this Mr. Hinks character has recorded his own version of the book in order to give it to the book club in town. So mixed in with the story, there are puzzles that you need to solve to advance the story. You kind of discover what's happening as you play through. You get new chunks of story. You get puzzles that unlock pieces. And then eventually, hopefully, you get to the end and you can figure out who done it through the clues in both the puzzles and the audio portions that are read to you during the game.
Yeah, I was mentioning before we started recording that I made sure to play this game before getting on here, just because you were nice enough to send it over. And your Mr. Hinks character made me laugh, like the audio recording of him. And his, I don't want to say he's a doofus, but like that's kind of the vibe I got. I was like, oh my God, no. This person's like, I barely did the homework and then I recorded what should have been the homework. And so it is pretty funny.
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually Anna's dad, who is our Mr. Hinks voice and has been throughout the games. Hinks is, the best thing I can say about him is just that he's enthusiastic. He's like, I want people to be having a good time, but also I don't want them to get like in a rut a little bit. I want to throw some unexpected things in there. And then the way that you might think something is going to play out, he'll turn it on its head. And just, I love the idea of twisting things in a way that you wouldn't expect. Twisting both in this sense of like a whodunit, like obviously there are twists throughout the book, but also how he's going to treat you and the other people of Hinksville.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool. So we're talking escape room style, so we're not going to give any kind of clue as to how it works. But the system itself, if you wouldn't mind kind of talking about that, and also like what made you switch into this like audiobook setting versus like what you'd done before, and what inspired like that type of story for this game?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, we try and design to what we want to play and what we're really interested in. Our previous games have been more direct puzzles. So you open up, you know, the box and you're going to get pieces of things that fit together that give you an answer. We've never leaned heavily into story, but that was something that we really wanted to do with the Blueprints game. We started with a whodunit because we knew that was something that we were really hot on at the time. We were really interested in trying to talk about mysteries that you're able to solve. That's one thing that's really important to us, is as you watch a movie or read a book or interact with a mystery, we want the clues to be there, like in plain sight. And so that if you go back, like when you get the reveal at the end, you're like, oh, I should have seen that. I could have known this part of it. And even to the point of like being able to go back and see, oh, that thing was, you know, in the frame in this scene. I could have guessed, you know, from that piece of information, I can put stuff together. It's kind of its own puzzle game in a way. We actually run our own personal book club, which is just the two of us. We try and find mysteries and whodunits, and the game is always like, who can get closer to the solution? We set, you know, boundaries of, okay, we're going to read to page 100, and then talk to each other and about theories that we have and what's going on. So getting into a story like that was really exciting to us. That was a space that we really wanted to explore. We didn't know how the audio part was going to work until we just kind of did it. But what we ended up with was you get an introduction from Mr. Hinks, as the story is that you are part of this book club in Hinksville, and they have exactly one book that they use, and they just solve that by passing this book around to each member of the book club.
They need a better library system. It's so funny.
Absolutely, they do. So they pass this book around, and unfortunately, the person before you damaged the book, lost the book, in kind of an odd way. Now you don't have a book, but you still need to go to book club. So Mr. Hinks has recorded what he remembers of the book. He doesn't have a great memory, and he gets kind of distracted talking about, oh, there's this dog that they mentioned in the book, so I'm going to go talk about dogs for a second, and now I'll come back, and or I'll talk about my favorite TV show. We try and keep everything in-universe, so if you've played some of our other games, you would know some of the things that he's talking about. He'll give you a couple chapters worth of narration, and then he'll tell you, okay, go ahead and open an envelope. I don't want to spoil anything for you, but I've gone and taken some pages from other books in the library, and I've drawn some like annotations on them. And he's kind of like being a little bit coy here, and he'll say, I'm not going to spoil anything, but I think if you look closely at the materials you gave me, you'll know what the twist is that I'm talking about. So he leaves you with a cliffhanger after a couple of chapters, and then he gives you the materials that you need to figure out that cliffhanger for yourself.
Yeah, I thought it was super fun. I mean, on the box, it says for 1+ players. For you, where do you think the sweet spot is in player count for this game?
My favorite way to play a game like this is definitely with two. We have played with a lot of playtesters who sort of run the gamut. Usually it's between 1 and we get up to as high as 4 sometimes. There isn't anything stopping you from playing with more. It's just sort of who can sit around a table and are there enough materials to be able to play in a way that one person is looking at something, and that doesn't mean that nobody else can be doing anything.
For me and my friends, it was the three of us playing, and we found that we had a good time because there was enough like materials in each envelope for each of us to be looking at least at one something. I really liked also that all the different pieces kind of crossed over into each other, where I know that like in some games you move backwards through things, where with this one it was very much like, hey, we completed this, we move into the next step.
Yeah, that's something that you'll see different styles in different games, and our design philosophy definitely leans towards like use something and then you're probably done with it. We often have kind of a single threaded approach. So you're going to solve a puzzle that takes you to the next puzzle that takes you to the next puzzle. Usually all of the puzzles are available when you start that chain, but the solution to one is going to help you, is going to give you like the key piece of information into the next puzzle. So that's the way a lot of our puzzles work. This one, in the Blueprints game, there are a couple of sections where you can actually be working on several puzzles at once and kind of in any direction, which is a little bit different for us, but they all do end up feeding into the resolution of a cliffhanger in each of these sections. So you do need to play, depending on which puzzle you start with, whichever one you start with, you're going to end up solving all of them in order to get that last piece, which is actually what you need.
And how do you go about playtesting these kinds of games?
Yeah, it is a challenge, and it's always really interesting because we have to have a decently large playtesting pool and also a pool of people that know kind of our style, because there's a lot of in-references into this world of Hinksville that we've done so much material on in the past. A lot of times what we'll do is we'll have someone test pretty much the whole game at once. In this particular game, we broke it into sections so someone could test, as long as it was in order of the chapters, you could break those down into chunks. We usually will have a Zoom call with them and just kind of watch them play through it. We'll ask, try and talk about your thoughts as you puzzle through these things. It's always all cooperative, so we're there to listen, to watch. It's an interesting experience because no matter how easy we think we've made something or straightforward, it is never as straightforward as we thought it was. There's inevitably sections where it's like we present an idea to someone, we give them a clue, and they go off in a completely different direction. We're like, oh, we need to signpost that better. We need to indicate like, oh, I see that you found this thing, but really you want to move in this other direction.
I remember when you were playtesting my prototype, you started making things so much harder, and I was like, what are you doing? You're like just making up math, and I'm like, what is, no, it's this very easy thing, and you've made it so hard on yourself. But I think that's one of the fun things with these kind of escape rooms, like the physical ones or the game versions.
Yeah, give people an opportunity to do anything that they want, and they are inevitably going to do not the thing that you expected. We have a friend who talks about escape room design, and he'll say, every escape room that I go to, I want it to be the experience, not this exact scenario, but I want to be in a dark room and there's a pedestal in the middle of the room with a light shining on it and a button that you hit. And that button starts the game. Like, that is the first puzzle. I've played games like that, and you would be amazed at how many times walk into that room and we're like, should we push that button? No, not yet. Let's dig around in the dark for a while. I don't know why that that exists in people. It's like, I see something I could do. I'm going to go the other way.
Yeah, I went to a physical escape room in Boston like a month or so ago, and there was so many puzzle pieces in the room that were so different from other things. Like, they wanted you to physically move like giant objects, which normally it's like, do not touch giant objects. Don't try to move them. But it's like that was the only way to find the hidden rooms. And then they had a spot where you had to pour liquid out into like a cauldron. And normally you'd be like, oh, I shouldn't open up this bottle of liquid and pour it on things. But nope, that's what you had to do. So it was interesting because the loudspeaker would be like, you know the things they tell you normally not to do? Well, do it here. Push the big thing.
Yeah. And in an escape room, there's not like a universal set of rules or expectations. Things that you would think are that way, there's always an exception. There's always someone willing to break that rule in order to try and give you a better experience. So I think it's interesting because walking into those rooms, they might tell you like a couple minutes of rules, but there isn't a rule book. There isn't anything that tells you really what you can and can't do. It's kind of the responsibility of the game master to say, like, to be watching you, to make sure you don't hurt yourself or anything. That was an interesting experience when we were sending out some of our Blueprints games for review, is someone asked for the rulebook, a link to the rulebook. And I realized our games don't have rulebooks. I had to email them and say, like, there's no rulebook, and that's intentional, but we've put enough signposting around things where I'm hoping that you open the box and you just are off on your way. Like, you have no hesitation about moving forward and knowing when can I open this thing versus when do I need to wait a little while, what pieces should I be using. It is an interesting problem to be able to be direct with people without spoiling anything and without giving them too much of a framework.
Oh, for sure. I remember my first escape room type board game, card game, whatever, was the Hunt a Killer series. It was Death at the Dive Bar. That was the first one that I played. And I found it so interesting because it was like, oh, here's all these like different papers and materials. And like, here's this like case that I have to solve. But it like didn't say, hey, if you do step A, then it goes to step B. It was more like, oh, you just have a bunch of crap in front of you. Let's search and look for clues. Like, it felt very much like I'm a Scooby-Doo character and I got to solve this case. But it was like really fun for me to kind of look at this stuff and be like, what doesn't seem right? What feels off to me? And try to go forward with that. But like for you two, do you guys have a set of rules for yourself when you're designing these different games beyond just kind of sticking to this made up world you made of like Hanksville?
Well, we also design for Grand Gamers Guild. We've got a line with them called Endangered Rescue, which is based off of the Endangered board game line. It's an 18-card escape room game. I think they're actually branding as 18 Escape now. What we've learned in doing that is that we like to set the difficulty and set the time that we want you to spend in each area before we actually write the puzzle or any content in it. We want to map out, like, this is the experience you're going to follow, this is the path you're going to follow, and this is how long we hope that you're going to spend in each section. Then when we playtest, we keep track of, you know, they opened this envelope here, now how long until they got the answer that allowed them to open the next envelope.
So when you're mapping this out, so the one that I just played, there was a section I definitely took longer in,
yes.
And there's ones that went faster. So you, before even writing out what each of these puzzles were going to be, or if it's like a logic puzzle or a number, like whatever you're basing it off of, you're just like, hey, I think this section should take like 20 minutes, or this one maybe 30 minutes. You kind of do it like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And for this particular game, we actually wrote out a spreadsheet about how long do we expect you to spend in each chapter, in each section? And then how long are we going to ask you to listen to audio for? And where we ended up going longer was actually the audiobook sections, because we enjoyed the narrative content of it a lot. So we wanted to give more story, and we liked kind of the voice that we found there. So we still ended up probably going longer on puzzles than we meant to, because everything looks easier as you're designing it. Even making things easier, our puzzles run a little bit long, but we did try and keep to sort of the way to think of it is like proportionally how much time you're going to spend in each section. So we want to start you off and like give you that puzzle that is hit the button in the middle of a dark room and let you really engage with the game quickly. Then you'll hear some story, and then you'll get a little bit of a harder challenge. And then another little bit of a harder challenge. And then at the very back end, we want to ramp that back down and give you kind of a quick win to get to the end of this mystery.
Yeah, that's super cool. And do you have a set type of puzzles that you want in every single game? Or do you mix it up? Do you repeat things? What is like your strategy there?
The most important thing to us is that there's a variety. So we don't want it just be logic puzzles all the way, which is probably what it would turn out to be if just me was writing it. Because that's, for some reason, that's always the first thing that I tend to think of, that direction. I work as a software developer in real life or outside of board games. So probably easy to think of myself as like tending towards logic type problems. But we know that everyone likes to do something different. You know, some people want to play a game of Sudoku in the middle of their mystery. Some people want to translate words sort of like Wordle or Mastermind style. They want to figure out what is the next word. Some people want a logic puzzle. Some people, you know, there's many different kinds of puzzles. We want everyone to find something that they like. And we also want to try and stay away from a couple of pain points. The big one usually ends up being math. As soon as people see math, even if it's like very basic elementary level math, they just totally check out. It has to look fun. It has to not feel like homework, and it has to not feel like the puzzle that you just finished. Because once you finish something, our thought is like, you finish it, you're excited, now let's go and do something else. Let's not ask you to do the same thing again.
I think that's a cool strategy. I feel like in escape room games, in person or like in a box, I tend to like it when they don't really repeat things, or if it's a repeat, it's like a leveled up repeat of what you kind of already learned. So it's like you're leveling up your skills.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a pet peeve of mine is when I see like, oh, that thing that I already did, I'm going to do it again now. It better be a lot of fun if I'm going to do it twice. It can really take you out of the flow that you're in. So allowing that to break even for a minute is just so hard to pick up that thread again.
Oh, for sure. How did you decide on when a game is ready? Like when you're going to self-publish?
A lot of it is sort of guesswork as far as what is the feeling that we want you to have and what puzzles do we want to include in this game? How long do we want it to play? And then we sort of design puzzles to fill that experience plus a little bit more. And then we start cutting things down. We remove some puzzles outright. We make a lot of them quite a bit easier, and we add a lot more signposting to make sure that along the way, you see like, hey, these fonts match here, so I'm going to look at these two pieces of paper at the same time. You know, you can use colors and, like I said, fonts, different types of design. Anna is really great at that, of figuring out, how can I show you two things And without you even thinking about it, you just know in the back of your head, like, those two things go together. We loop a lot on that design process and figure out how can we make it so that people are enjoying this and so that they're feeling like the thrill of hopefully continual progress while also feeling good about solving problems and about the challenge level that they have accomplished. I'll say that when we get to our first playtest, we're in a very rough form. And it is purely to say, do these puzzle mechanics work? And a lot of times they don't work. Or we say, oh, it wasn't actually fun for our playtesters, so let's shift our idea, let's rotate, let's merge these two puzzles together or tear this one apart into two pieces. And the signal that a game is ready for publication is that we can show it to our playtesters and not have pages of notes at the end. So we know our playtesters pretty well, and we know when they become frustrated, it can really bog down the experience, and it cannot be fun to run that playtest. But seeing the other side of that, when they're like snapping through all of the puzzles, and they're like, yeah, I remember this thing from over here, and that's going to go to this piece. And, like, you can kind of imagine in an escape room, like, running from place to place. There's a different energy when you're like, oh, I know what to do, and I've got, like, three wins in a row, and I'm going to take this piece and put it over there, and I bet something cool is going to happen. So as soon as you can gain that trust from your players, you get in a really good spot, and that's what we wait for as a signal of like, okay, this is ready to go, for us to hit print on, which we do all of our own publishing, for us to order materials and to start making this thing fully final draft, real, ready to be published.
And how do you decide on what materials to use?
That is probably our biggest problem. A really interesting question, because that's very important to Anna, is to have a variety of materials. And also, we have to acknowledge that as a small publisher with a fairly small market games, we don't always have an opportunity to get the pieces that we want to use at scale. Or like, we can't even get to a scale where it makes sense to include certain pieces in our game. So most of our games use a lot of paper. We try and make sure that we're using, different thicknesses of paper, different textures, make sure that each piece looks like you would expect it to look in real life. So if we have a newspaper, we want to use a real newsprint. If we have, a magazine page, when I say a magazine page, hopefully you can get a sense of like that in your head.
Yeah, kind of thinner, glossy.
Yeah, exactly. Sourcing those materials is always very difficult. What we did for this game was we relied heavily on a printer here in the U.S. that does sort of printing for advertising and marketing type companies, I think is mostly what they do. We paired all the files ourselves, sent those over to this printing company, and then we actually ended up packing each of the boxes ourselves. So identifying what we can put into a game often ends up sort of feeding back into that original question of like a plan for how long is this game going to run? How many different components are we going to allow ourselves to have in each of these chapters? Because if you say, like, I remember we had a game that we scrapped not too long before this. It actually sort of transformed into the Blueprints game. One of the things that we wanted to use was tiles. So we wanted to use, you can imagine like a Carcassonne tile or something like that. That was a thicker cardboard or chipboard, something like that. And as we were developing this idea, we came to realize, like, if we want to make this game at our scale, the price point is just going to be something that people aren't going to be willing to bear for a game that you really are intended to play once. So we need to make sure that we're staying in that price point and giving you a game that is going to sell at about the price of an escape room ticket. And it's going to give you, probably between 3 and 5 hours is usually what we're looking for as a game. So it ends up being very constrained. And we've managed to find this company that will work with us in a lot of those ways, but also is still limited to it's a lot of paper craft for us.
I mean, I feel like if the narrative's good and the puzzles are, I doubt anyone cares. Have you ever had complaints on that?
Well, it's funny because inside of sort of the at-home puzzle game community, there's obviously a lot of preferences But one of the things that we see people get really excited about is having like an artifact in the game, to the point where they've got, you know, a display case of all the artifacts that they have found or solved something in games that they played. So, you know, just thinking off the top of my head, I know one game has like a Viking horn that comes with it. Another one has, you know, physical puzzle boxes that you're going through and inputting a code in, or a cryptex is kind of the classic example of like, what can I take from a game and then display in my house? There are, when something like that comes out of the box, people are very excited about it. And that goes a long way towards getting that energy going of like, yeah, this is really cool. And what we find is more interesting to us is the puzzle side of things. So I don't care if I see this artifact come out of the box, if I've got like three or four bad puzzles leading up to that, I just like, okay, this is a thing that now it made the box heavier, it made the game more expensive, and what was the fun part for me was the puzzle. It's interesting. There are a lot of different views on what makes a good at-home puzzle experience.
I would have never thought about it, but a lot of those games I have played, I guess there would be something I could have framed if I had chosen to. The friends I was playing with tonight, they taught me early on when we were playing the Grand Gamer Guild's Holiday Hijinks games to use those like clear sheets so you could like dry erase over them. And so we were using that for the game. And oh my God, I love it so much. I don't know why I've ever tried to play a puzzle game without them. It makes it so I can reuse and pass off the game in the future to someone else, so that way I can share the love.
Yeah, absolutely. And we, you know, definitely encourage anyone to do that sort of thing. We want to spread puzzles around as much as possible. So there are a lot of good ideas about how can I play a game without destroying it. That we like to try and make sure our games are not destroyed. But then if that is going to happen, our games always include a reset kit if you need to mess with a particular component. And we also hope that, like you said, you use some sort of plastic covering, lamination, something like that, to allow you to give it to the next person, because you probably know someone who will enjoy it.
That's so awesome. And how long do you think it took from like the beginning of the idea to it getting printed and sent out to people?
Yeah, so we ran a pre-order in around Thanksgiving in 2024, and then we delivered in the very end of January, so like February 1st of this year. So a lot of the development, the actual development and playtesting and design happened, let's say from the end of October through that period. So probably 4-ish months. But the roots of this game, I think I mentioned earlier, actually come from another game that we started to design that was still set in our Inksville world. It was meant to be kind of an introduction to the town and to a couple of other games, because we've got several lines of games in Hinksville and we want to give you a good place to start. And there hasn't always been a great place for that. So it was going to be like, you've just moved to the town and the realtor gives you this mysterious package and it's like, okay, you know, you've moved here, you're a citizen now, have fun. And hopefully, you know, you kind of discover the world as you're playing this hopefully very accessible game. So we worked on that for a couple of months, didn't really like the direction that it was going, and we kind of shifted to another idea that tied back into the Curious Elevator. We have a follow-up to that elevator game called The Curious Stairs. So it was going to be a third part of a trilogy of those games, which might still happen eventually, but that was when the component issue came into play. So, like I said, we wanted to do something that was more expensive than we had in our budget. That kind of stalled us and kind of stopped that project a little bit. So when we were looking for our next thing in like August or September of last year, we kind of rechecked that last game and said, what can we do with this that's going to be exciting? And at the time, we were, like I said, very into like whodunit mysteries, wanted to see what we could do with more narrative exposition than we'd had in the past. And we came up with this idea, like, what if this isn't a book? What if it's actually an audiobook? We can, you know, we don't want to write 200 pages of story because we wouldn't want to read that. How can we keep you moving on this? As a very long-winded answer to that question, the roots of it are, I don't know, probably a year and a half old, and the actual development and design are probably 4 or 5 months long of real dev and design.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. It sounds like you definitely explored a few different areas. And did you have like a favorite and a least favorite part of that?
There were definitely high and low points. I think my favorite part of it was probably resolving what we were calling kind of the meta puzzle, which is kind of the culmination of you get to the end and you actually receive the blueprints in your box and you can start following the journey of these investigators as they're like running through this house trying to track down the answer to that they've been looking for. We had a lot of trouble getting into that idea and figuring out what should it be, but Anna made some small suggestion, and for some reason there was just a moment where like that totally clicked, and it was like, oh, they need to be moving fast, and they need to move from room to room, and because of that, you know, you can use this sort of different framework for saying like for identifying those rooms and then puzzling that along the way. It worked out really cool. So I think kind of the high and the low were like right next to each other. We got very near the end of the design of the game and we're like, how does this end? How do we do the last puzzle? And we struggled with it for a long time. So that was the low point. And then through some, you know, small suggestion, Anna just totally like blew the roof off of things and was like, yeah, this is right. And it's just one of those moments where like, yes, 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 like keep going. And we ended up where we are. It's really cool to see how it resolved itself with just coming from kind of nowhere, it felt like.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, that's really great. I also think it's kind of nice at the end to have a fun, different kind of puzzle, but it's almost, not to say a give me, but a shorter one as like your victory lap.
Yeah.
And that definitely felt like a Scooby-Doo version of like running around and then your victory lap. So yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Do you have other games? I know you mentioned the 18-card escape rooms you're working on. Do you have another one coming out with Grand Gamers Guild that people can look out for? Any other projects?
Yeah, so we have finished game two of the Endangered Rescue games, which I'm not sure how Mark is going to want to market those, but it's the second one in the line. The second one is going to be about the lemur leaf frog, which is an endangered frog in Costa Rica mostly. It's a really cool animal and a cool game. It's meant to be slightly easier than the first one, but one that we're hoping to continue kind of the experience of I'm playing a game and I'm learning something hopefully interesting without even really knowing it. So we have a third game lined up there. We know what the animal is going to be. I don't think we can talk about it yet, but there is some more coming up. We're going to continue. Our plan is to continue another audiobook. If you see on our website, when you log in to play this game, you'll see the Blueprints game, and then you'll also see kind of a teaser of another game that's going to be available. We're hoping to have that available for order. We're thinking probably around fall this year, so October or November. Yeah, but then just keeping up with some of our other games. I mentioned the Curious Elevator. That's always a good place for anyone to start if they're interested in checking out some of our puzzles. We do free puzzles on our website a lot of the time, just little mini ones. And got lots of ambition for things that we want to do. And because it's just the two of us, it'll take a little while to do some of those things. Some lean more towards like a traditional board game, and some of them are going to be more like an escape room.
Do you have any like pieces of advice for people trying to make one of these escape room games, either the ones that you're doing for Bluefish or the ones that you've been hired to do for the 18 card game?
Yes. My first piece of advice would be always make it easier. Like, I think playing a lot of these games, like the whole point of playing them is to have fun. It's not fun most of the time to just really hit your head against something. So Anna and I have played in the last couple of months, for some reason, many puzzle hunts, including the MIT puzzle hunt that just happened, I think it was in February, it may be January of this year. And that is really meant to like, to really test you. And people love that sort of thing to like, how can I make the hardest challenging thing that I can? And I want you to leap from like five different connections to get to an answer. And every step along the way, you're going to be like, doing your own research and coming up with new ideas and everything. I feel like there is certainly a group of people that want to do that, but most people, they're looking for fun. They're looking for how progress through a game and then to kind of be done with it, but along the way, they don't want to feel punished. So for someone making a game, I would say, like, you're not the enemy. It's not you against them. You want to play with your players. No matter how clear you think something is, there will always be someone who doesn't see it right away or who thinks of something differently. Don't hit people over the head with an answer, but provide plenty of signposts and allow the players to really discover things. Don't feel like you have to pit yourself against them.
I think that's good advice. I like that in your games, you put like keywords and stuff into other pieces of information to kind of lead you to be like, hey, this is linked with this thing.
Yeah, in Endangered Rescue especially, there's lots of, there's even icons sometimes of like, you should go look at the website because there's a little piece of information that's going to help you there. It's not always that direct, but we don't want people to be stuck hitting their head against the wall. That's probably not fun.
No. When you were describing that super long one, I was like, oh God, I'm falling asleep listening to this. I would hate to do that. That sounds like a project. And I like puzzles. I love puzzle games. And you're totally right. Like, I thought I created a lot of easy puzzles, but because they're different types, some person might not be into like spatial puzzles where other people are like, I can nail those because I'm more into that. I've never really liked wordplay ones quite so much. And if it's super mathy, I also am like, ugh, math. So it's kind of nice to have a group so you can pass those on to the people who like those types of puzzles.
Yes, very much.
Well, here for my last question, unrelated to everything we've been chatting about. If you could have been the designer of a different game than ones that you've already made, what would you have chosen?
Yeah, I had a chance to listen to some of the past episodes, so I anticipated this a little bit.
You're prepared.
Yeah. And I came up with two that I really like. The two that I was thinking of are Space Base and Adventure Tactics. And I, after thinking about them a lot and trying to narrow it down to one or the other, I think I'd like to stay with both of them. And I really like those games because I think both of them offer an abundance of anti-hitting your head against the wall. They offer you an abundance of cool stuff that you can do. They give you the power to feel really good about your character in the case of Adventure Tactics and your tableau or your ship in Space Base. So Space Base is going to give you resources on everybody's turn. I had never seen that before, and I thought that was so cool that how can I keep people engaged on someone else's turn, but also just constant like hits of like of dopamine kind of saying, oh, I get something more. Like, oh, like this is great. And yeah. Even if things cost more later, bring on the abundance of stuff. In Adventure Tactics, you kind of get that same feeling because at every chapter, you're going to fail forward if you fail at all. Whether you pass or fail in a scenario, it's almost always the case that your character is going to level up and is going to become better and become cooler. And you will need that for the next level. But you go from this feeling of like, oh man, we didn't win that chapter to like, oh, but my character gets to do this now. And you know, the bad guys better watch out in the next chapter because my cards are, you know, this much better. So both of those games are just constantly giving you a sense of like, yeah, you got this. Like, do the next thing. You are cooler than you ever have been, and you are going to get cooler yet.
I think those are good examples. I have never played Adventure Tactics before, but it sounds really interesting. And Space Base is great. I mean, I really should get John DeClaire on my show. Now that I think about it, he has not been on it. So maybe I'll go harass him.
Yeah.
Plug his brain about it because you're not the only one who's brought it up before in an episode.
Yeah, I would love to hear that. He's got so many just kind of like just a little bit twisted ideas that just creates a really cool experience.
I agree. I think he's good about coming up with interesting mechanics or unique components and doing something a little different with it. I think that's why he's so successful and why AEG, he seems to be like their boy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So funny. Well, I super appreciate you and everyone else who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 114, The Case of Curiously Correct Blueprints. And Ace, thanks for being on the show. For anyone trying to find these games or anything else you guys are working on, where can they follow you?
Yeah, the best place to find us is our website. So that is teambluefish.com, T-E-A-M, Bluefish. And the best way to follow us is probably on Instagram. I think Anna handles most of that side of things, but we're around in general under the handle Team Bluefish. So Instagram, Facebook, our website, any of those are good channels to talk to us.
Sweet. And I'm Danielle Reynolds, your host. If you're trying to find me, I'm still on Instagram. I barely have an X. It'll probably go away soon. And then I have Blue Sky under Token Gamer, spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R. Also, Board Game Geek. Look me up there if you want to find some of the games I work on, or dmrcreativegroup.com. Thank you, Ace, for being on the show. This was super fun. I love chatting with all the different kinds of escape room designers, and I feel like I need to have one per episode, or season, I should say, not episode.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out AllPlay at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.